On April the 16th at 2 p.m. North American Eastern Time, blind musicians from across the globe are getting together for an online benefit concert for Ukraine. It's called We're With You, and all money raised goes to the World Blind Union's Unity Fund for Ukraine. To learn more, including how to listen and how to perform at We're With You, visit mushroomfm.com/withyou. That's mushroomfm.com/withyou.
AccessCast, an Accessibility initiative, presents Unstoppable Mindset, the podcast where inclusion, diversity, and the unexpected meet. Hi, I'm Michael Hinkson, Chief Vision Officer for Accessibility and the author of the number one New York Times bestselling book, Thunderdog, the story of a blind man, his guide dog, and the triumph of trust. Thanks for joining me on my podcast as we explore our own blinding fears of inclusion, unacceptance, and our resistance to change. We will discover the idea that no matter the situation or the people we encounter, our own fears and prejudices often are our strongest barriers to moving forward. The Unstoppable Mindset podcast is sponsored by Accessibility. That's ACCESSIBE. Visit www.accessibility.com to learn how you can make your website accessible for persons with disabilities and to help make the internet fully inclusive by the year 2025. Glad you dropped by. We're happy to meet you and to have you here with us. Hi again, and welcome to another episode of Unstoppable Mindset. Today, I'm really honored and proud and pleased to invite and have someone on the podcast who I've known for a while, and he's moved up through the world of working with blind persons and disabilities over the years. When I first met Kirk Adams, he was the CEO of the Lighthouse for the Blind in Seattle. He is now the, would it be CEO, Kirk?
President and CEO.
President and CEO of the American Foundation for the Blind. But more important than that, I mean, that's just a little thing. More important than that, in 2019, he became a PhD. He became, as my mother used to say, a doctor. Anyway, so Kirk Adams, welcome to Unstoppable Mindset.
Well, it's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So you have been involved in the blindness world for a while. Tell us sort of maybe some of the early parts about you that you want to talk about growing up and how you ended up being involved in blindness and advocacy that stuff.
Well, it's interesting, and I'll just kind of start where I am and then I'll zip all the way back. But you know, I'm very, very interested in social justice and a more inclusive society. And of course, the way I come at that is through my lived experience of blindness and working hard day and night to create more opportunities for inclusion for people who are blind in society. And in particular, I'm very interested in employment. As we all know, the workforce participation rate for people who are blind is about 30 or 35%, which is about half of the general population. And I say whatever outcomes you're looking at, it's either half as good or twice as bad for people who are blind compared to the general population as far as employment goes. But, you know, I'm at AFB now. We're very much a research-focused organization. And when we do research and we look at the factors that lead to successful employment for blind adults, I, through good fortune and mostly not on any effort of my own, I lived a life that gave me a lot of those success factors. So it really started when my retina is detached when I was in kindergarten. I became totally blind within a couple days, had a bunch of emergency retinal surgeries that weren't successful. This is pre-laser surgery. And so my parents were told, you know, Kirk cannot come back to school here at the neighborhood school. He needs to go to the state school for blind kids. And we live north of Seattle. My parents visited the Washington State School in Vancouver. We're not very impressed with what they saw there. They were both teachers just starting out on their careers. And my retinal specialist at University of Oregon Medical School in Portland said, you should check out the Oregon State School in Salem. It's great. They visited, they liked it. They quit their jobs, moved. So I could go to Oregon State School. And the success factor here is I was totally blind. There was no question. Does he need to learn Braille? Does he need to use a cane? You know, there's so many kids with, you know, varying levels of vision that are unfortunately not always given the right instructional curriculum. So kids are, you know, using magnification and audio and not learning Braille, but there was no question. And we know that strong blindness skills are a strong predictor of successful employment. So I learned to read and write Braille as a first grader and type on a typewriter and use a white cane. And a little aside, one of the happiest days for me is when the Braille book review comes, and one came last week, and there in the children's book section is a book by Michael Hingson. I think Running with Roselle.
Running with Roselle.
Yeah. Yes. So there it is. I put it on my request list, so I'll be reading it.
Let me know what you think.
And then, you know, my parents, although they didn't know any blind people, I grew up in small towns. We're not connected with you know, blindness organizations. They instinctively did a couple things right. One is they had very high expectations of me. They expected me to get good grades and expected me to participate in sports. Expected me to do chores, and they didn't always help me figure out how to do it, but the high expectations were there, and we see that as well as a predictor that if parents and schools have high expectations of blind kids, they do well.
Well, thinking back on your parents not telling you how to do it, what do you think of that? And I'm sure it's different than what you thought at the time, but what do you think about that as part of your life experiences?
Well, I'd say I learned how to, it was sink or swim. So I learned how to swim. I was in public school. I was the only blind kid in all, you know, my schooling. I, you know, kind of had to wing it a lot. And I don't think my psychosocial needs were attended to much, but I did learn. And this is another point. Living every day as a blind person, you have opportunities to develop characteristics in some really unique ways and some strengths that the average person may not have, around resilience and problem solving and grit and determination and how to work with teams, how to communicate. When I went to college, you know, I had some money from the Commission for the Blind to hire readers. So I was 18 years old. I was interviewing and hiring and sometimes firing employees, readers, and you know, invoicing and taking care of the accounts and those things that my classmates were not doing. The other thing I had, early work experience. I was really into sports. My dad was a high school basketball coach. I wrestled, ran cross country, and I became the sports editor for the high school paper. And the sports editor for the high school paper got to write a weekly high school sports column for the city weekly paper. So I was a 16-year-old sports columnist writing a weekly column for the Snohomish Tribune, and filling out my timesheet and getting a check and happily spending that minimum wage. I think it was $3.25 an hour, something like that. So, again, I had some of these early, I had some of these success factors that lead to successful employment for people who are blind. And my opportunity at AFB is to create those opportunities for lots of other blind people. So we develop programs that, you know, seek to level the playing field for people who are blind. We are focused on employment. And I had the experience as a young college graduate with a good track record in school, Phi Beta Kappa and a cum laude and a 4 point in my field of econ, and could not get a job like many young blind people. We are the most highly educated, most underemployed disability group as far as college graduation, things like that. So I wanted a job in finance. I started applying for jobs. I wanted to live in Seattle. I went to college in Walla Walla. Needed to live where there was a bus system. Yes. So I sent in resumes and cover letters, would get a phone interview, would be invited in for the in-person interview. And then, the employer would be very confused about why a blind person is coming and applying for this job. How in the world could they do it? Disclosing your disability is a thing. When do you do it? So I wasn't disclosing until I walked in with my cane and my slate and stylus and some braille paper in a folder. And then I started disclosing in my cover letter, saying I'm totally blind. This is how I do what I do. This is how I'll do the job. And then I wasn't even getting phone interviews. So
yeah,
I cast my net wider and wider and wider. And I applied for with a securities firm, a sales job selling tax-free municipal bonds. And the sales manager had also gone to Whitman College, had also been an econ major like 15 years before me. So he called some of the professors that we had and they said, sure, Kirk can sell tax-free bonds over the phone. So I did that for 10 years, straight commission, 50 cold calls a day, every day, builds strong bones. And when I turned 30, had an opportunity to make a change. The firm I was with was purchased by another firm, and just a good inflection point. And I got the What Color Is Your Parachute book out of the Talking Book and Braille Library and read it and did all the exercises and got clear that I wanted to be in the nonprofit sector. And I wanted to be in a leadership role, and I wanted to devote the rest of my working life to creating opportunities for people who are blind. So the next little blind kid could have an easier time of it. And got very interested in leadership. I went back to school and got a master's degree in not-for-profit leadership. Got involved in nonprofit fundraising, was hired by the Lighthouse of Seattle to start their fundraising program and foundation, and eventually became the CEO there. And simultaneous to that, again, really believing leadership is key to changing our world, I went back to school, as you mentioned, and earned a PhD in leadership and change through Antioch University.
I know that the first time I heard you speak was when you came to the National Federation of Blind Convention after just becoming, I think, the CEO.
Ah, yeah, it's in Atlanta.
In Atlanta. Yep. I had gone to work for Guide Dogs for the Blind. We were having challenges at GDB because people would not create documentation in an accessible format before meetings. And I recall you talking about the concept of no braille, no meeting.
No braille, no meeting. That's
which
right.
Which I took right back to them. And it helped a little bit, but it was amazing to see that there was such resistance at such a prestigious organization to hiring and being open to hiring blind people, given mm-hmm. what they do. And it was a real challenge. Bob Phillips, who was the CEO at the time, created the job that that I had. And I'm sure that, I know there was a lot of resistance to it, but he was the CEO and made it happen. But still, the culture was not oriented toward being open for blind people to have jobs there. And there are a few blind people working there now, but not even what there was several years ago, which is unfortunate because there are a lot of things that could be accomplished by blind people in various aspects of that organization. And as you point out, of most organizations, you and I had a lot of very similar life experiences growing up, which is, I think, just evidence of what needs to be done for kids who are blind. And I'm defining blind as Ken Jernigan used to, which was you're blind when you lose enough eyesight that you have to use alternatives to be able to accomplish tasks. And I gather you agree with that. When you were in college, did you have an office for students with disabilities on campus? And if so, you didn't?
Not
oh, good.
All.
Yeah.
I went to Whitman College, which was small. You know, I graduated from high school in 1979. So I got a, had the 4-track cassette player, and I got books read by volunteers by Recording for the Blind. And the state provided me with a Perkins Brailler and the cutting edge technology of an IBM Selectric typewriter with erase tape. So that's what I had.
Well, I asked the question because when I went to UC Irvine, we had an office, and Jan Jenkins, early on when I started there, said to me, she lectured me. She said, "Now I want you to understand what I do here." And this is her. She said, "I'm here to assist. You need to take responsibility for doing things like going to professors if you want books in Braille and getting the books and doing the things that you do. But my job here as a principal in the university is if you can't get the cooperation you want, then you come to me and I'll help you do it," which is such a refreshing attitude today, because in the offices for students with disabilities, mostly today, you come into our office to take a test, or we'll get the information for you, we'll get the things for you. And as you pointed out so eloquently, students as a result don't learn to do it. And like you, I had to hire and fire readers and do all of the same sorts of things that you had to do. And it's the only way for us to succeed.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, if you look at research and you look at what employers say they want in employees for the 21st century, it's employees who are resilient and flexible and have grit and are problem solvers and are creative and know how to analyze and manage risks and know how to work in teams of diverse people. And in my conversation as well, if you're looking to win the talent war, blind people, by the fact of living every day, lived experience of blindness, learn how to do all those things and develop those capabilities, develop those characteristics.
I think I've told the story on this podcast before, but I, like you, debated often about whether to say that I'm blind when I'm writing a cover letter for a resume. And in 1989, I was looking for a job, and my wife and I were talking, and we found this great job in a newspaper. It was perfect. And I said to her, I said, "Well, should I say in the cover letter that I'm blind?" And my wife, like wives all over, can say this. She said, "You're an idiot." And I said, "Why?" And she said, "What is it you've always said that you learned when you took a Dale Carnegie sales course when you started out selling for Kurzweil?" Well, she was ahead of me, as often is the case. And finally, she said, "You've said that you tell every salesperson that you've ever hired and every person that you've ever managed in sales, turn perceived liabilities into assets." And I think that's the key. Because blindness isn't a liability, it's a perceived liability. And what I did is I went off and I wrote a letter based on that. And I actually said that I'm blind. And the way I did it was I said in the last paragraphs of the letter, "The most important thing that you need to know about me is that I'm blind. Because as a blind person, I've had to sell all of my life just to be able to survive and accomplish anything. I've had to sell to convince people to let me buy a house, take my guide dog on an airplane, pre-ACAA and ADA, rent an apartment and all that." So when you're hiring someone, do you want to hire somebody who just comes in for 8 or 10 hours a day and then goes home after the job is done? Or do you want to hire somebody who truly understands sales for the science and art that it is and sells as a way of life? So, I mean, that I think is the whole point of perceived liabilities. Well, I did get a phone call from them. They were impressed by that. And I got the job and worked there for 8 years.
Fantastic.
And I think we all need to learn how to, whatever job that we do, to take that same sort of approach, because I think most any job could adapt that same concept to say why blindness is a perceived liability on the part of the employers and why we're best for the job because of the way we live.
Perfect. Now, I'm thinking about Carol Dweck's work on this growth mindset versus the fixed mindset. So it all holds together. Assets-based philosophy, etc.
Well, it does. And, blindness is a perceived liability, and for us, only as much of a liability as we allow it to be.
I think that's back around to expectations too. As I mentioned before, my parents held high expectations of me. Therefore, I held high expectations of myself.
Yeah.
I know that not every blind kid is in a family situation like that. I've talked to many blind parents who on first learning their child is blind or going to be blind, just despair and, feel that their child has no future and they'll be in a caretaker role. And so it's really, really important that the high expectations get established early on. And like I say, not every blind kid is born into a family that's going to do that automatically. So that's an opportunity for all of us who are blind to talk to parents of blind kids, and something I really enjoy doing, and letting them know that your kiddo can do whatever they want to do as long as they are given the right tools and supports.
And the opportunity.
Yeah.
How do we get parents who feel desperation and so on, how do we get them to change their minds?
Well, I think it's exposure. And I think it's exposure to blind adults, successful blind adults. I'm a big advocate for both consumer groups. So if someone's listening and are not connected with blind adults, blind people, the National Federation of Blind, American Council of the Blind, comes in different flavors. They have chapters and different groups and affinity groups, and I would suggest checking it out. I think that's one way. I think that's an important way. And it's the same in the workplace. I'll keep harping on research. It's shown that if a department or a manager hires a blind person, they're much more likely to hire another blind person than another department hiring their first blind person. So, familiarity, understanding the capabilities, understanding that people are people with the same emotions and drives and hopes and dreams and all the things. I will, before I forget, mention a workplace technology study that we just did. And it was very well designed. We did focus groups, interviewed, then created a online survey, then did in-depth interviews, just to understand the dynamics of technology in the workplace for people who are blind. What's working, what's not working, what tools do people use for which functions. And it's available on our website. So afb.org, easy website to remember. Yes. We've done four or five, I think, really important studies in the last couple of years, and all that data is there.
You were talking a little bit earlier about what employers are looking for in terms of being flexible and so on. Where does loyalty fit into all that in today's world? You used to hear about people staying in jobs for most of their whole time, and now it's a lot different. But where does loyalty fit?
That is a super interesting question, and I don't think there's clarity on that. And I was just reading an article this morning about the 10 greatest risks faced by corporate boards. And one of them was the uncertainty of what the workplace is going to look like in the future. Strategically, how do you build your workforce and your talent pool, not knowing exactly what the workplace is going to look like? So couple things that come to mind. One is that people change careers. I can't cite the numbers, but something like seven or eight job changes now in a lifetime of work. And the trick is to manage that person's career path while keeping them in your organization if you value them and you find that they're a great contributor and you don't want to lose them. So it's a different type of conversation. You tried HR, you don't like it that much, you'd rather be in IT. You know, how do we create a pathway to keep a person within the organization? And then the next, you know, we've had the great resignation here with COVID, and so many people, it's been a wake up call for so many people to say, hey, life is too short. I want to do something that's meaningful. I want to live. I moved from the East Coast back to Seattle to be closer to family. Mm-hmm. So people are making those kind of life-based decisions that I think are much greater rate now. I would say that the shifting landscape in employment, I believe, will create more opportunities for people who are blind as remote work, telework, and hybrid work situations become normalized. You know, there is language in our statutes that says, you know, setting up a person to work with a disability, work from home, is the accommodation of last resort. Now, that was the assumption was that everyone needed to go into the office and everyone needed to be in a building with their coworkers, and to set up a person to work from home was the last accommodation that should be considered. And I think that's been flipped now. Yeah. So I'm really excited to see what it's going to look like.
I think that it is a moving target for everyone. And the key is to allow blind people to be part of that flip. And I think that you're exactly right. It will be interesting to see where it goes. I asked you that question because one of the things that I've often heard is a blind person who is hired to work somewhere will tend to be more loyal and want to stay there rather, and will do a better job as a result rather than
And that's going out. And that's verifiable. Look at disability research. DuPont did a really long longitudinal study, 50s, 60s, 70s, that people with disabilities are, you have less turnover, you have less absenteeism. Morale in work groups goes up. Customer perceptions improve. So there's good business cases for employers to include people with disabilities.
Yeah, it makes good sense. And you know, we see in so many different ways that there are advantages to being blind, which all of us also need to learn how to explain and emphasize. Another one that comes to mind, we've used it at Accessibility a fair amount, is the concept of brand loyalty, which is a little different, but the Nielsen company did a study in 2016 talking about the fact that people with disabilities in general, and I'm going to narrow it to blind people, tend to be a lot more brand loyal to the companies online that give them access to their stuff because they don't have to slave and work so hard to get access to it, and they're going to continue to work with those companies.
That makes sense to me.
It is just absolutely relevant that we need to get more of those messages out and make it happen. Of course, that's one of the reasons that we have Unstoppable Mindset, is to hopefully educate people about some of these things, because it makes perfect sense to do. And there's no reason why we can't get better access. It's just a matter of educating employers and a lot of the decision makers who are not blind that we're actually an asset to them.
Yeah, and I'll mention an AFB. I think one of our crown jewels is our annual leadership conference. And it'll be May 2nd and 3rd in Arlington, Virginia. When I first went to work for the Seattle Lighthouse in 2000, the person who hired me said, if you want to get to know the blindness field, you need to go to the AFB conference. So I went to my first in 2001. I've never missed. And it's fairly unique in that we bring together all the stakeholders. So we bring leaders from Voc Rehab, the federal agencies, nonprofit CEOs, corporate diversity, inclusion, and accessibility folks, academic researchers, blindness advocates into the same space. And that's a really interesting thing to do because those groups don't often talk to one another, although right. they would all say they share a common goal in improving employment outcomes for people who are blind. There's a really cool research study where they asked VR counselors and HR hiring managers the same set of questions. And the one that stands out to me was the question was, what is the greatest barrier to successful employment of people who are blind? And the VR counselor said, attitudes of employers, perceptions of the employer. And the employer said, lack of understanding of our business needs on the point of VR. So, you know, both groups would say they are very dedicated to improving employment outcomes, but they come at it from different angles. So AFB Leadership Conference is a place where we bring all those stakeholders together in conversation. So it's pretty cool.
And hopefully you can get them to communicate a little bit more with each other.
Yes.
I don't know. It is interesting. Do you ever watch the ABC show, What Would You Do?
I have not.
Have you ever heard of it?
I don't think so.
John Quinones has run this show in the summer every year for a number of years. And one of the whole premise of the show is that they bring in actors to play roles and see how the people who are around them react. So for example, on one show, it was actually one of the first shows, they brought in an actor to play a barista at a coffee shop. And this was, I think, put on or created by the Rochester Institute for the Deaf. They brought in two women, deaf people, and there was a job posting and they went in and applied for the job. And the whole process for the barista was to simply say, no, you're deaf, you can't do the job. And he did a really good job of that. But these two deaf people kept saying, well, we could do the job. This is a kitchen job. You're not asking for me to even interact with customers all the time. And he said, well, what if there's something I need you to do? Well, you can write it down or I can read lips. And he just continued to resist, which was great. But during the day that they did this, there were three HR people who came in. And they, after listening to all this for a while, pulled the barista aside and they said, you're handling this all wrong. These people have more rights than the rest of us. Just take the application and write on it, it's not a good fit. But don't keep arguing with them. It was fascinating that the HR people did that. So, yeah. You know, there is a problem with HR, but again, that's what we have to help educate in all that we do too. So I'm glad to see what you're doing and that you are bringing people together. Mm-hmm. I've been to a couple of the leadership conferences, but not lately.
Well, so I have to work we'll that see out. We'll see you in May.
But yeah, we got to work that out.
But the workplace technology study I mentioned earlier, there's real data there from real people, current. So we can show HR managers that, hey, blind people report that if part of your recruiting process involves some sort of online exercise or test, 60% of your blind and low vision people are having challenges, accessibility challenges with that.
Yeah.
You know, 30% of the people you're hiring are having problems with your employee onboarding processes. So, you know, there's anecdotal stories, there's complaints, but now we have real data. So it's really intended for the HR manager, the IT manager, and assistive technology developers to really show what's actually happening. You know, how your blind employees are needing to take work home and use their own equipment and work more hours. And, you know, they're having to ask sighted colleagues to do essential steps in their processes. And, you know, people hear those stories, but now we've got we've got numbers and we got statistics. And, you know, an HR person doesn't want to say, you know, 30% of this group of people is having problems with my onboarding process. You know, that's a number that is going to get some attention, we think.
We hope so. And we hope that we can continue to find ways to get people to be a little bit more aware of all this, because accessibility to the tools is one of the biggest challenges we face. You know, that's why I joined Accessibee last year, because I saw that there were opportunities, and Accessibee has even expanded a lot and is saying that what it does to create internet access, which began with an artificial intelligence system that does a good job with some websites and a significant part of websites, but also doesn't necessarily do everything. And Accessibee has now put together additional processes to create human intervention to help with the rest of it. But Accessibee also wants to educate people about web access, whether they use Accessibee's products or not, because the feeling is we've got to do more to educate people. And that's exactly what makes sense to do.
Yes. And as I mentioned before, we began our recorded part of our conversation, AFB, NFB, ACB, and the National Rights Disability Network have drafted a joint letter to the Department of Justice asking them to implement the web and app accessibility regulations that they are empowered to enact. And we have a sign-on letter. Again, you can go to afb.org for more information. And we're looking for disability and civil rights organizations who want to join us in urging the Department of Justice to do that, because it's so meaningful. I'm not a high-tech person. Like you said, I'm brand loyal to a small number of retail websites. But we also did a study last year as part of what Mississippi State National Research and Training Center on Blindness was doing. They contracted with AFB. We looked at 30 corporate websites, and we looked at specifically at their recruiting and hiring portals. And there's lots of accessibility issues. So
there
are. So
even with 508 compliance for the government, there are a lot of accessibility issues.
Yes. So whatever we at AFB can do to change that landscape and to change the way institutions, government, nonprofit, corporate address inclusion, put it under the umbrella of digital inclusion. I think it's somewhat similar to we've morphed from diversity to inclusion in our language. I think we've morphed from the digital divide to digital inclusion, which I think is a much more proactive concept.
A speech I've given for years is actually titled "Moving from Diversity to Inclusion," because diversity doesn't even include us anymore, which is unfortunate. And so we've got to go to something that makes more sense. And you're either inclusive or you're not. You can't be partially inclusive, because then you're not inclusive.
There you go. I'm stealing that one.
You're welcome to have it. It's yours.
Thank you.
Go right ahead. Because you either are inclusive or you're not. It's a quantum jump. You can't be partially inclusive and say you're inclusive. You shouldn't be able to say you're partially diverse and so you're diverse. But you know, that ship is kind of sailed.
Yep.
But I think it is something that we need to do. And it's all about education. And it's all about finding ways to give kids at a young age the opportunity. And you talked about Braille earlier. How do we get the educational world to recognize, again, the value of Braille? What's happening with that?
Oh boy!
I know that was a loaded question, wasn't it?
that's my personal soapbox, which I can get on and stand on. I don't know how to do it other than frame it in terms of literacy. It is a literacy question. Reading is reading, listening to something is listening to something, writing is writing. You know, if we didn't need to read and write, then sighted kids wouldn't be taught how to read and write. It's just a matter of efficiency and efficacy and art and being a human being in a literate society. So there are some numbers embedded in some of our research that show the number of employed respondents who are Braille readers or use Braille displays. There were some numbers generated 30 years ago that indicated that 90% of blind people who are employed read Braille. That doesn't appear to be the case now, based on what we can infer from our surveys. I'm not sure what that means. So I will say, to answer your question, I don't know, and we need to figure it out. So,
well, I think
that's some deep research questions that I would be energized to explore.
Take what you said to another level. Let's say you're right. 30 years ago, 90% of employed blind people were Braille readers, and that number has dropped, just for the sake of discussion, let's say significantly. The other thing that immediately comes to mind is how far people who are blind, especially who are not Braille readers today, are advancing as opposed to yes. Braille readers. Because Braille is the means of reading and writing. I know so many people who are partially blind who have grown up not having the opportunity to learn to read Braille, who are very blunt about saying, if we had only been able to learn to read and write Braille, we would have been a lot better off, because it's just so much slower and harder for us today.
Yes. And I hear people with those same regrets. And again, it's back to what I said earlier, that as a becoming totally blind at age 5, there was no question I was going to learn Braille, and yeah. I was instructed in Braille. And it wasn't a question or a debate. And who knows what would have happened if I would have had enough usable vision to read with magnification. So I guess along the same lines as what you mentioned about Dr. Jerninger's definition of blind, you know, if a child cannot read at the same rate as their sighted classmate using magnification, they need to learn Braille so right. they can read just as fast as their kid at next desk.
You know, otherwise, why do we teach sighted kids to read? Just let them watch TV.
There you go.
And which is another technology and art form or whatever that isn't as creative in some ways as it used to be, but there are also good shows. So I guess we got to cope with that too.
But yeah, audio description is not our thing at AFB, although right. we appreciate it immensely. And I know some other blindness organizations are really carrying the torch to increase the amount of audio description. But that just brings to mind that accessibility and innovation around accessibility for people with particular disabilities is good for everybody.
Yeah.
And I know my wife, she's puttering around the kitchen and there's a movie on, she'll put the audio description on, so she can follow it. When I was at the Lighthouse in Seattle, we worked with Metro Transit to put larger bus numbers with contrasting colors, because we have had a lot of employees with RP, a lot of deafblind right. employees with ushers. And they did enlarge the bus numbers and put them in contrasting colors. And they said they had more positive comments from their general ridership about that than anything they'd done, because it made it easier for people with 20/20 vision to see if that was their bus coming.
Sure.
Simple example, but
one of the things that really surprises me still And I've mentioned it before, and so it's one of my soapboxes, is Apple put VoiceOver, partly because they were compelled to do it, but put VoiceOver on iPhones, iPods, iTunes U and all that. But on iPhones and iPods and the Mac, they put VoiceOver, they created it. But I'm very surprised that in the automotive world, they haven't done more to make VoiceOver a part of the driver experience so that people don't have to go look at screens on their iPhones or whatever, as opposed to being able to use VoiceOver, because clearly it would be a very advantageous thing. And I also think of like the Tesla, which uses a screen, including a touchscreen for everything. And my gosh, yeah, you can do a little bit more of that because the Tesla has Copilot that allows you to interact in some other ways, although you're still supposed to keep your hands on the wheel and all that. But why aren't they using voice technology more than they are?
That's a good question that I can't answer.
I know I've never heard a good explanation of it as to why they don't. And it makes perfect sense to do it. The voices are very understandable, much less dealing with Android and so on. But no one is using the voice technology and the voice output to take the place of screens, which is crazy, much less voice input. So it is a mystery. And it is one of those things that it would be great if people would consider doing more of that. The automotive industry is missing out. And of course, we as blind people are the ones who bring that opportunity to them. We'll take credit.
There you go. Well, you know, when I was in walking around with my 4-track cassette player listening to textbooks, I was the oddity in school. And now everyone listens to Audible books.
Right.
It's
a common thing. And now, not only that, you can use things like bone conducting headphones, so you can listen to your audio as you walk around and still hear what else is going on, so you're a little bit safer.
Yeah, and I don't know how far afield you want to get in this conversation, but indoor wayfinding navigation systems, many people are trying to figure that out. You know, the GPS systems work pretty well when you're outdoors, but when you're indoors, what are the wayfinding tools that are emerging? And I'm thinking about haptics and different modes of receiving information than audibly, because most of the adaptations, accommodations for people who are blind tend to be audible. And if you get 2, 3, 4 things going at once, you get a diminishing marginal utility there. And then at some point, you know, it becomes counterproductive if too much is going on audibly. So I went to Consumer Electronics Show, CES, for the first time this past January. And I was very interested in kind of the emerging use of different modes of conveying information, either through vibration or temperature or airflow, you know, different types of information. So lots of smart people out there trying to figure out ways to make us all live better.
Yeah. We'll have to hunt down Mike May and get him on the show, because he can certainly talk our ears off about indoor navigation.
Yeah, you should.
We haven't done that. I've got to get hold of Mike. I think that would be cool. But it is all part of, as you said, making all of our lives better. And the whole concept of virtual reality is something that all of us can take advantage of and use. And again, a lot of the things that come about because of some of these developments actually started with blindness. I mean, look at Ray Kurzweil with the Kurzweil reading machine. He developed the technology to be able to let a camera build a picture of a page of print. And his first choice was to develop a machine that would read out loud, of course, for blind people. Of course, he took it further after that. And now OCR is a way of life. But it did start with Ray with that machine, the Kurzweil reading machine for the blind.
Yep. I remember it, big as a washing machine. Now you can do it with your iPhone.
You can, and better. how much our computer processes have evolved over the years. It's really pretty incredible, isn't it?
It really, really is.
And, you know, but technology is all around us, and it is a good thing, but again, it's all about how we use it and how we envision it being used. So it gets back to the discussion that we had about Braille. You know, people say, well, you don't need Braille because you can use recordings and all that. Well, that's just not true. Why is it that we should be treated differently? Why should our exposure to being able to read and write be different than people who have eyesight? Because reading and writing with Braille is really equivalent to reading and writing with printed page or pens and pencils, mm-hmm. or typewriters and all that. And you mentioned running with Roselle earlier. I remember sitting on an airplane going, I think I was flying back to California from somewhere. And we were going through many revisions of Running with Roselle at the time. And Jeanette Hanscom, who was my colleague in writing that, who writes children's books. So she was able to make the words something that we felt would be more relevant for kids. Although I got to tell you, more adults buy Running with Roselle than children do, so I've heard. But I spent the entire time flying from the East Coast to the West Coast, going through and editing Running with Roselle. And I was using a computer that talked, but I also know that the skills that I learned as a Braille reader gave me the ability to catch nuances and so on that I never would have been able to learn to catch if I hadn't learned how to truly be able to read a book. And we edited the book, and you know, it is where it is today.
Well, it's on its way to me from the Talking Book and Braille Library. I look forward to reading it. And congratulations on yet another publication. Good on you.
Well, thank you. We're working now towards another one, writing about fear, you know, and you know, especially with the pandemic all around us. And gosh, fear has taken on many forms, some of which are understandable and some of which are ridiculous. But we're looking at the fact that, well, when I left the World Trade Center, I didn't exhibit fear. And that was because I learned what to do and approached the day when an unexpected emergency happened from a standpoint of knowledge. And I had actually, as I realized over the last couple of years, developed a mindset that if something were to occur, I mean, obviously something could happen and we could have been smushed by something, but without that happening, I could step back and quickly analyze whatever situation was occurring as we were going down the stairs or getting out. And I could focus on that and let the fear that I had not overwhelm me, but rather instead be a mechanism to keep me focused. Mm-hmm. So it's developing the mindset. So we're working on it, and we've got proposals out to publishers. So we're hoping that that's going to go well, and you know, we'll Fantastic. See where it goes.
Well, as mentioned earlier, I am president and CEO of the American Foundation for the Blind. And yes. as such, I am scheduled to be on a Zoom call with our finance and investment committee of our board of trustees.
Well, we're going to let you go, but I'd like you to tell us if people want to reach out, or if you, wherever you want them to go to learn more about AFB or you and reach out to you. How do we do that?
Yeah, afb.org is the website. My email address, if you want to email me, is my first initial K, my last name Adams, KADAMS at AFB.org. And AFB and myself are present on social media, and you can find us easily. And we'd love to connect, get your thoughts, share our thoughts. Check out the Leadership Conference May 2nd and 3rd in Arlington, Virginia. And go to afb.org and look at our research.
Well, perfect. Well, thank you very much for being with us today on Unstoppable Mindset. We very much appreciate your time and hope that we'll be able to chat some more.
All right, Michael. Keep up the good work.
We'll do it. If you'd like to learn more about Unstoppable Mindset, please visit www.michaelhingson.com/podcast or go to wherever you listen to other podcasts. We have a number of episodes up. We'd love to also hear from you. You can reach me directly at Michael H.I., that's M-I-C-H-A-E-L-H-I, at Accessibe, A-C-C-E-S-S-I-B-E.com. So Michael H.I. at Accessibe.com. Would love to hear from you. If you've got suggestions of people you think that we ought to have on the podcast, please let me know. We're always looking for guests. If you want to be a guest, let us know about that as well. And most important of all, please, after listening to this, we'd appreciate it if you would give us a 5-star rating in wherever you're listening to podcasts. The ratings help us and they help us show other people that we're doing something of interest. So if you feel that way, please give us a 5-star rating. Thanks again for visiting us today. And we'll see you next week with another episode of Unstoppable Mindset, the podcast where inclusion, diversity, and the unexpected meet. You have been listening to the Unstoppable Mindset podcast. Thanks for dropping by. I hope that you'll join us again next week and in future weeks for upcoming episodes. To subscribe to our podcast and to learn about upcoming episodes, please visit www.michaelhingson.com/podcast. Michael Hingson is spelled M-I-C-H-A-E-L-H-I-N-G-S-O-N. While you're on the site, please use the form there to recommend people who we ought to interview in upcoming editions of the show. And also, we ask you and urge you to invite your friends to join us in the future. If you know of anyone or any organization needing a speaker for an event, please email me at speaker@michaelhingson.com. I appreciate it very much. To learn more about the concept of blinded by fear, please visit www.michaelhingson.com/blinded by fear. And while you're there, feel free to pick up a copy of my free ebook entitled Blinded by Fear. The Unstoppable Mindset podcast is provided by AccessCast, an initiative of Accessibe, and is sponsored by Accessibe. Please visit www.accessibe.com. Accessibe is spelled A-C-C-E-S-S-I-B-E. There you can learn all about how you can make your website inclusive for all persons with disabilities and how you can help make the internet fully inclusive by 2025. Thanks again for listening. Please come back and visit us again next week.